Welcome to What in God's Name. She is Shana Appel.
And he is Chris Owen. And you have tuned in to the podcast that looks at contemporary events through the lenses of theology and philosophy and psychology in an effort to get us all past the binary of politics and economics, which takes up so much of the public square.
We're steering a course midway between the programmatic secularists and the quasi-theocrats. The programmatic secularists are people who, as a way of approaching public questions, want religion and theology out of public conversation, believing that religion should merely be, just be, private. To them we say no, there are riches in our theological heritages, plural, that we need to draw on to have a fuller picture of individual human flourishing and collective human flourishing. At the same time, we push back against the quasi-theocrats who are more than delighted to have religious conversation in the public square, just as long as it's our particular theology. To them, we say no in this beautiful, beautiful, amazing plurality that makes up American public life. We need different voices. No one particular voice can be the one and only. The richness of our public conversation is its diverse nature. We do serious reflection on our show, and we like to have a little bit of fun. We have a spinny wheel, and our guest today, Angela Pape, I'll speak more about her in a moment. Angela, I'm going to ask you to describe, if you would, the spinny wheel that you see.
It's a bicycle wheel. Looks like it's a little ratty around the edges. And it's on a board with black, white, gray, red, and tan triangles, and little yellow sticky notes.
You are the first person beyond Shana and me who will give that puppy a spin. Would you care, please, to spin the wheel?
My pleasure. Human flourishing.
Human flourishing is where the pointer has landed. Thank you, Angela, for giving that puppy a spin. So our spinny wheel is populated with 16 different core values and key ideas. Angela has given it a spin. We begin our show with just a little riff on wherever it lands as a way to welcome those of you who might be discovering What in God's Name for the first time. Human flourishing is a key concept for our show.
It is perhaps the key concept to the show. I mean, if somebody were to ask me, you know, why I'm here and why we do this, I would have to say that my drive is all about human flourishing. As a minister, my life is about human flourishing. And I think for me, and Chris, I suspect the same is true about you, you know, we see a lack of human flourishing right now across our nation, in large part because of this hyper-focus on the financial and the political. And there really is no place in either of those conversations anymore for human flourishing. I mean, largely because we do not have, we do not have an economy based on human flourishing, and our politics don't seem to be based on human flourishing at this point either.
Our guest today is Angela Pape. She's the executive director of the Monadnock Interfaith Project. She does faith-based community organizing here in New Hampshire, but for those of you not in New Hampshire, this model travels. In contrast to the merely political and the merely economic, those constrictive and diminishing narratives that dominate the stories we tell about ourselves and our communities and about how to be successful. In contrast to the narrowness of those perspectives, an alternative way to tell the story of people coming together to have power together for the common good is the story of faith-based community organizing. So I intuitively felt, as I came in contact with faith-based community organizing through Angela's work, I intuitively felt like this was just a great, great fit for What in God's Name and the What in God's Name mission. It's also a way for people with religious commitments to be public, which is another question that's important for what in God's name, based on what you already heard us say in the show opener about the secular and plural nature of our public life. How then can faith-grounded people be welcomingly, openly present in the public square, in a plural society? How do we bring our faith to bear? So for those two reasons, I'm really excited to have Angela here. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
You did a great job spinning our wheel for us today.
It was fun.
Yeah, good. I wanted to give you an opportunity to introduce yourself to our audience. Just say a little bit about who you are and what you do.
Sure. Well, my name is Angela Pape. I've been in faith-based community organizing about 15 years. I originally got into the work seeing it as an effective way to accomplish systemic change, and initially was not so sure about the congregational piece, given my own personal background, and then quickly grew to see people in these congregations were incredible people with incredible love for other people and all sorts of different theologies and an openness to people having different theologies and an openness to working with people from different perspectives, and really saw the power to accomplish change. I started organizing in Ohio and a couple of weeks into the job as a new intern of this organization, there was a meeting with 2,000 people and the mayor and a lot of city councilors in Columbus, Ohio. And they committed to expand hours at their health clinic. A couple of years before, they had one affordable housing units, but middle class people were getting a deal. So they were pushing the officials on actually getting people into these units that really needed them. And so, you know, I both love the day-to-day aspect of the work where you're working with people, you're sharing deep stories, and I love the collective impact that it's been able to have.
What do you love? Not about the work you do necessarily, although it's related, but what is the love that drives you to do this work that you do?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think it's hard to put your finger exactly on it, but I think there's this deep undercurrent of connection and love between human beings. And, you know, as a community organizer, when I was initially trained, it was about anger. What makes you angry? And that just didn't really resonate with me. That felt short term to me. And sure, there are times that made me angry. I have this particular memory when I was a young adult. I was actively involved with a day women's homeless shelter in Boston, and that's in a church in the basement on Newbury Street, which is like a very expensive shopping street. And I remember walking down that street one night with some friends and seeing some of the women who I knew and cared about sleeping on the steps of this church, knowing that they were at risk of getting raped. You know, lots of terrible things could happen to them. And this was, you know, right next to stores that you have jeans that cost $300. And, you know, that made me really angry. So yes, I've had moments of anger, but I think it's this deeper undercurrent, a sense that people are deeply connected. And I love other people. I love my own family that's gone through struggles. And this overall sense that, you know, it's a deeper, stronger motivation to have a world and our systems based on love and fairness and respect that I want to be part of.
I love that. And I think Shana might have a follow-up to that, but I wanted to ground our listeners a little bit more in community organizing. If you can define that and just help our listeners get some context as to what it is. And then I would love to return to that really amazing distinction that you drew between being motivated by anger and being motivated by love. Give our listeners a little bit of context on community organizing.
Sure. So community organizing as a whole loosely follows a process of first listening and network building, where people are sharing their stories, are sharing challenges that they face in their lives. And in the context of faith-based community organizing, usually it's a 6-week or a 2-month period where people in their congregations, sometimes in their wider neighborhoods or networks of relationships, are holding lots of small group meetings, lots of one-on-one conversations. And then we bring all that together and look at where the themes are. And so, and often there's a whole voting process where people put them into groups, and then there's, you know, congregations or institutions or individuals vote on what feels most important. And it really matters. What are the collective issues that are facing the community at that point? And then there's a research phase of looking at what's currently going on, what are the gaps, what are the opportunities, what are the best practices in other places. And I would say systemic change and changing the wider environment is the focus. It's not about just helping someone with food today. It's around making larger changes in the environment of that town, that state, et cetera. And then you work towards a concrete change. And then there's often these larger action meetings where you bring together hundreds of people or thousands of people and negotiate, publicly negotiate with officials on particular changes. So I would say, you know, that's loosely the organizing process. You know, over the last 10 years, I've seen it really broaden and become more creative. And there's a lot of conversation around narrative that I think is really important. And I think that changing the larger narrative is a piece of winning bigger and bigger changes. Just some other pieces that are really important. So story sharing is huge, you know, as people build relationships and also as a way to achieve change about really putting a human story to the challenge. Leadership development is huge. And this sense that everybody has abilities and talents and can lead meetings, can negotiate with officials, can grow in their leadership skills. And I would also say I really feel like when cities or towns can have an effective community organization, you know, I've most experienced with the faith-based community organizations, there's a process for challenges people are facing in their lives to be raised, to be acted upon. And when you have this people power, often changes are won, which is really exciting.
Just trying to, again, give our listeners a little bit of grounding and context. Can you share the story of, I think, change in a school?
Yeah, sure.
So briefly, can you kind of tell that story since it grounds us in a particular case? Part of my question is, in addition to faith-based communities, what other groups then can potentially be involved? And I wonder if the example of that community that wanted to be involved in the school could answer that question as well. Poor Shane is trying to get in, and I'm just hogging the microphone, so she can yell at me when the microphone gets passed over. She's not looking amused. I'm in big trouble, folks. Go ahead and tell that story.
Sure. So in this particular city, they held this listening process, and a lot of families were sharing about challenges with the school system and feeling frustrated that their kids were, you know, they didn't feel like we're getting a good, strong education and, you know, wanting their kids to be prepared to be successful adults. And so that was the major theme that was coming out of that listening process. So they chose to focus on public education and started trying to both better understand the problem. They saw that the you know, test scores were way under where they should be in reading and in math. And so they started to look at best practices. What are people doing in other cities? There's a whole small innovative schools movement where there's more freedom for teachers and schools to adapt to unique situations. And so they decided to lean into this as a change in their school district and put forward. One of the schools was a bilingual school. Another one was focused on arts and music. And so they came up with, here's the change we'd like to have within our larger school system. And then they looked at, well, who are the decision makers here? What's the role of our superintendent? What's the role of the school board? What's the role of the mayor? You know, the mayor played a big role in the budget. So they looked and better understood how the change could be made, and then started to engage with these officials, held a large meeting with about 600 people where they were both sharing stats, sharing personal stories, both of the problem and of examples of how that change was successful in other communities, and gained public commitments. And several of the school committee members, I think, agreed to make changes and to try this new way because there was this outpouring of community support that really wanted to do this. And then they had to stay on them. You know, they got these commitments. Then you have to show up at the school board meeting 3 months later and make sure they follow through. And do they actually open up the schools? So there's an ongoing piece to it as well.
I'm going to share the microphone with my partner, Shayna.
Angela, I'm wondering, have you done enough community organizing in non-faith-based groups to be able to discern any differences between the two groups? Like, what's it like to do community organizing with it? Are there any differences organizing in secular groups versus organizing in faith-based?
It's a really good question. I mean, my experience is in the faith-based groups. Initially, one of the reasons I got into it is I had a friend who was doing neighborhood-based organizing. And every year it was a new 22-year-old knocking at people's doors. And, you know, people didn't really trust the 22-year-old and they, you know, need to take care of their kids at night. And so they couldn't go to these meetings. I think one of the strengths of faith-based community organizing is it's you're organizing institutions, which are already networked people. So I think that's huge. I do think there's a role for all types of organizing, though. I was really struck my work in Massachusetts, and I was my particular role at the time, I wasn't super central in this work, but there was a really amazing effort called Raise Up Massachusetts, which the faith-based community played a really big role in, but it was unions, it was community groups, it was, you know, faith-based community organizing. And collectively, we won a $15 minimum wage. We won paid family medical leave. You know, we made really good progress on a millionaire's tax, and that's coming around again. So I think that there's importance of all different types of organizing. While religious, you know, attendance at religious services is declining, there's still a lot of people that go to church. And if you want to organize people, that's an important piece. I'll also say, I think there's an element in congregations around caring for others and around this concept of love. And I think there's, at least with congregations that have gotten involved with faith-based community organizing, there's a sense of dignity and hope that helps people stay in the work for the long term.
So I'm curious, I'm thinking back on something you said about when you started community organizing, you know, the question is what pisses you off? What makes you angry? How do you work? One of the things that we've asserted here on the show is that the core question the world's faith traditions is trying to answer is, how shall we live together? Can you perceive a difference between work done in the secular realm versus the work of faith-based? Is there really, and there may not be, any difference?
It's a good question. I still think there's a depth with faith-based community organizing that it seems more surface level often in a secular setting, but everyone comes to it from different perspectives. And I do think people with deeply held values, it is similar. I think that what I've seen with faith-based community organizing is a lot of people get involved in change that probably wouldn't have otherwise. And I think that's exciting. So, and I think it's often because their pastor or religious leader or, you know, scriptural study is really pushing them on how did Jesus lead his life? And, you know, if we really look at Jesus's life, Jesus was spending time with people on the margins. Jesus was trying to change the systems in their community at that time. And so I think a key piece is the teaching around it. And I feel like often if clergy get really clear on this and are pushing and challenging and supporting the congregation, you know, you have little old ladies who used to just be happy, you know, doing their once a week at the soup kitchen, who start to ask these larger questions and feel motivated around, how do I be part of change in my community? So
that feels to me like the magic that I was sort of hoping would come up somewhere. Even if they can't articulate it, they're being driven by it. You know, there's a difference between worshiping Jesus and following Jesus. And yes, Jesus dwelled with the marginalized. So did Muhammad, may peace be upon him. So did Moses. So did Buddha. You know, it seems that when the prophets come, where do they land? They don't, you know, they don't land in the gilded realm.
Mm-hmm.
They land with the people who need them,
mm-hmm.
and the people who are most marginalized. So, yeah, I was just sort of hoping that some of that was present.
To draw this first part of our conversation to a close, I wanted to try to put together two threads that you've named. One being circling back to this distinction between being motivated by love and being motivated by anger. So hold that. And then you didn't say this, but it arose in my hearing of your story of the community organizing around the educational change in that particular. That was a community in Massachusetts.
Yes,
yeah, New. So it seems to me, as I was listening to that story, that it takes perseverance and time.
Mm.
You have to stick with it.
Yeah.
And the connection for me is, and I'll just say it, but it's really a question, and I wonder, to be motivated by love seems to me to be more sustainable than if you're motivated by anger. Although anger can be real important. It also seems to me that faith-based communities are equipped to be in it for the long haul, which is what is needed. Agree? Disagree?
Yeah,
anything to add to that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's, you know, most people who go to congregations plan to be there for a long time. And, you know, you realize these different, you know, pieces of your faith and ways that you're called to be in the world are ongoing struggles, ongoing opportunities, ongoing work. So I think that longevity is a really big piece of it. And I think when you have an organization, you can have particular clergy come and go. But if you have that vehicle that people can be part of that's enduring, that's really an important piece.
Yeah, and I think a piece of it that I'm talking around a little bit is that we're also grounded in a narrative that it's God's story that's unfolding in the world. And that transcends lifetimes.
Mm.
That's where I was going. I just didn't name it quite so explicitly as that. I mean, the stories that we attach ourselves to are stories about participating with God in fulfilling God's vision for goodness and peace that was God's original intent.
Mm-hmm. There was something that I heard in the midst of what you were saying, Chris, that is also true in faith communities, is that you're doing the work in community. So it's one thing if you go to a march or a rally and then you come home. And if no one else in your home is involved in the work, it's really easy to slide back again into that sort of political economic, which generally gives rise to a lot of cynicism and not a lot of hope. But if you're in a, you know, if you're in a community of faith, if you're in any kind of community that is a solid community, that is longstanding, as you said, then you have, siblings in faith to travel the road with.
We've been talking with Angela Pape, who is the executive director of the Monadnock Interfaith Project. Join us for part two of this conversation next week. We're going to focus on questions of relationship building, which is such an essential part of faith-based and any community organizing. Today's show is brought to you by our generous donors on Patreon. Join our generous donors on Patreon by going to Patreon. If you become a Patreon supporter at this time, you will receive a special invitation to preview a short film that I have made called The Intention of Our Hearts. You can find us on Facebook at What in Gods, and you can sign up for our newsletter at our website, whatingods.com, which is whatingods.